Chapter 4, The March to New Orleans. I enlisted at Portage on the 20th day of February, 1864, being then 32 years of age. That is the plain line the record keeps. It gives the place, the date, the company, and the regiment. It says I entered Company C of the 23rd Wisconsin Volunteer Infantry, the Portage Rifles. It does not say how long I stood before signing, nor whether my hand was steady, nor what words passed between Janet and me before I left the house. The record is often like that. It preserves the step after it has been taken, but not the weight of the foot before it moves. I was not a boy when I went. I had been a husband twice over, a widower once, a father with children old enough to know my face and young enough to forget the sound of my daily tread if I stayed gone too long. Elizabeth was 6, James was 5, Sarah Ann was 3. Little Edward was only about a year old. Janet was 24, and the burden I left with her was not a light one. Her people were near, and that was a mercy. But no father or mother or brother can be a husband in a house where the war has taken him away. The war was in its 4th year. Men younger than I had marched away in 1861 and 1862 with music in the streets and flags above them. Some had come back with sickness on them. Some had come back with limbs gone. Some had not come back at all. The 23rd Wisconsin had been mustered at Camp Randall in Madison in August of 1862, long before I joined it. By the time my name was put down, the regiment had already been under fire, had served in the Vicksburg campaign, and had learned what soldiering meant in heat, mud, sickness, and death. I did not enter a new regiment. I entered a veteran one. That fact mattered. The men of the 23rd had gone down the Mississippi before me. They had seen the river as a road of war. They had served under General Grant, and the name of Grant meant something to men who had watched Vicksburg fall. I was going to them late, a replacement to a body that had already suffered and proved itself. A man who joins late must learn quickly that he is not the measure of the regiment. He is the one being measured. What the record does not say. If I try to remember that morning, I do not hear drums. I hear the small sounds of a house trying to remain a house after the father has put on his coat to leave it. A child at the door. A chair moved back. Janet's voice kept low because courage is sometimes a quiet thing and not a brave speech. She had crossed an ocean as a child and knew something of distance. Still, the river road south was not the Atlantic, and war was not emigration. She had children about her, and more life to carry within her and around her than one pair of hands ought to have borne alone. I could not promise her what no soldier can promise. I could say only what faith permits a man to say when the world has become uncertain, that I would trust God and write when I could. If I held her hand at the last, the record did not keep it. If one of the children asked when I would return, the record did not keep that either. But a man does not go to war from an empty doorway. He goes with every face in the doorway walking after him. From Portage, I was sent into the machinery of the army, and the first machinery was not cannon, but paper, rail, drill, and waiting. Civilian life ends by degrees. First comes the name on the roll, then the order to move, then the camp, then the clothing, the weapon, the haversack, the canteen, the blanket, the mess, the command shouted across a yard, the knowledge that a man may no longer choose when to sleep, when to rise, when to walk, or when to stand still. Camp Randall at Madison was the place where Wisconsin turned men into soldiers. I came there in the last of winter, when the cold still lived in the ground. Snow lay in corners and shaded places, and the parade ground could be mud under one foot and frozen ruts under the next. Men brought the smell of farms and towns with them, and the camp laid its own smell over all. Wet wool, smoke, lamp oil, leather, damp straw, coffee, and close bodies in barracks where too many men breathed the same air through a long night. A man remembers his first army shoes. Brogans are not the soft boots of home. They are stiff at the start and have to be argued with by the foot. A sack coat hangs differently from a farmer's coat. A forage cap makes a man look more like the others than like himself. The canteen knocks against the hip. The haversack pulls on the shoulder. A blanket rolled and slung is no great weight at first, until a man has carried it all day. A gum blanket is a poor thing to admire, and a useful thing to own when the ground is wet. Then came the gun. I had handled tools all my life, but this tool had only one purpose. Its barrel held the smell of oil. Its wood had the smoothness of many hands or the newness of issue. Its weight was not more than a man could bear, but it changed the arm that carried it. A hoe asks the ground to open. A rifle asks a man to be ready to kill or be killed. No speech from an officer can teach that as quickly as the first hour a soldier stands with his weapon and understands that it is now part of his duty. We drilled in lines until the body began to obey faster than the mind could protest. Left, right, wheel, halt, shoulder arms, order arms. Men who had been masters of their own barns and fields found themselves corrected like schoolboys. Some laughed. Some cursed under breath. Some learned quickly because pride is easier to swallow in camp than on a battlefield. The seasoned men could be known by how little motion they wasted. The green men could be known by how often they looked at one another to see if they had done the thing correctly. Food was another lesson. Hardtack is honest because it does not pretend to be more than it is. Salt pork teaches patience if hunger has not already done so. Coffee boiled black in a tin cup can seem like a sacrament when a man is cold enough. We ate standing, sitting on boxes, crouched near fires, or wherever the order of the day allowed. A man who had sat at a family table learned that the army feeds the body but does not comfort it. At night in the barracks, the room did not settle all at once. Men shifted in blankets. Someone coughed. Someone told a story too loudly. Someone prayed low enough that only the boards beneath him might have heard. Someone wrote home with the paper laid against a trunk or his knee. Someone read a letter until he had worn out the meaning, and then folded it carefully as if folding the hand that wrote it. There were card games, jokes, rough talk, and silence. A Baptist man need not join every amusement to understand why men seek them. Waiting has its own temptations. The army did not keep us at Madison forever. The purpose of Camp Randall was movement. We had not been gathered to remain near the lakes and farms of Wisconsin. We were bound south to join a regiment that had already gone before us. And so the camp began to loosen its hold. Orders passed. Names were called. Men checked their gear, rolled blankets, slung haversacks, and made themselves into a column fit to be moved. The first miles out of a place are always the sharpest. Whether a man rides or walks, the leaving happens in the chest. Madison fell behind us by rail. The wheels took up their iron rhythm, and the cars carried us away from the last familiar distances. A train car of soldiers is its own kind of camp. The benches are hard. The air is close. Coal smoke finds its way into clothes and hair. A man tries to sleep sitting and wakes with his neck stiff and his mouth dry. The car rocks and jerks, and every stop throws men against one another as if reminding them that the army moves bodies before it moves souls. The countryside went by in winter colors at first, then in the dull thaw of early spring. Farms, fences, woodlots, depots, water tanks, town names called out and gone. At stations, men leaned from doors for air. Engines took water. Coal was handled. Civilians looked at us, some waving, some staring with the sober look people give soldiers when they know the uniform is not a pageant. Children came near until warned back. Women watched from platforms and windows. More than once, I thought how any one of them might have been Janet if the place and hour were changed. Chicago, if our road took us through or near it, as such routes often did, was the kind of city that makes a farmer feel the smallness of his own road. Smoke, tracks, yards, wagons, voices, brick, iron, the press of commerce and war together. Yet even the largest city was only a passing place. The army did not carry us south to marvel at buildings. It carried us because the Mississippi had become a military road, and Cairo stood like a hinge between the rail world and the river world. The farther south we went by rail, the more the weather changed its mind. Cold still found us in the cars at night, but the days softened. Mud appeared where snow had ruled. The smell of the earth changed. Men began to loosen coats when they could. The talk changed too. At first it had been of home, bounty, equipment, officers, and whether letters would follow. Then it became talk of the river, of Vicksburg, of the regiment, of Banks, of the Red River, of what had been heard and what could not be trusted. Every mile south made the 23rd more real and farther away at the same time. We were moving toward it, but news moved faster than we did, and less reliably. One man had heard the regiment was near Alexandria. Another had heard it was marching up country. Another had heard the rebels were gathering in strength. A soldier learns that rumor is a ration also. It may nourish courage for an hour, but it cannot be trusted to sustain a man. Cairo was the place where the land journey gave way to water. There the Ohio and Mississippi met, and the town was crowded with the business of war. Boats lay at the landing, smoke rising from stacks, gangplanks set, freight piled, animals restless, officers calling, soldiers tramping, wagon wheels striking boards, barrels rolling, ropes creaking under strain. The river there was not a quiet thing. It was broad, brown, busy, and alive with purpose. The first step onto a steamboat is not forgotten by a man who has lived by fields and smaller waters. The deck shifts underfoot. The engine beats through the boards. The smell is river mud, smoke, steam, hot iron, damp rope, cargo, and men. The boat is both road and house, carrying its own noise with it. A train hurries and shakes. A steamboat labors and breathes. When the paddle begins its work and the landing slips away, the river takes command of the journey. Down the Mississippi we went. Replacement men, detached men, soldiers in transit, all of us carried by the same current and the same government need. The river widened the war. On land, a man sees where his foot may fall. On water, the banks pass as if the world is being unrolled for him. The upper habits of Wisconsin and Illinois gave way to bluffs, bends, bottomlands, towns marked by occupation, and stretches where the trees seemed to stand in water and the air thickened by the mile. Life aboard the boat had its own order. Men slept where they could, on deck, against freight, near railings, under cover if they were fortunate. Boots became pillows. Blankets became walls. The engine did not sleep, or seemed not to. Its beat entered the body. At night a man could wake and not know at first whether he was hearing his own heart or the machinery pushing him deeper into war. Meals came when they came. Coffee again, hard bread again, pork again, whatever the army and the boat could provide. Men ate with the river moving beside them. Some watched the banks. Some spoke of home. Some became quiet the farther south we went. There were songs at times, and laughter, and talk too foolish to preserve. There was also the long looking that comes over men when they have nothing to do but travel toward danger. The boat stopped for wood, for orders, for cargo, for reasons known to officers and pilots before they were known to us. At wood yards, men could see the labor that fed the engines. Corded wood, muddy banks, black laborers, soldiers, boat hands, the quick exchange between shore and deck, then the whistle and the onward push. The war was not only battles. It was fuel, rope, coal, rails, pork, paper, orders, and the bodies of men delivered where they were needed. Memphis, if seen from the river, stood as a sign of how the war had changed possession of places. A city may be held by one side and remembered by another. Soldiers on a boat do not know the full history of every wharf they pass, but they feel when a place has been fought over. The riverfronts carried scars of use. The talk aboard carried names of campaigns. Men who had been longer in service pointed or spoke with the authority of those who had seen more than I had. Then came the memory of Vicksburg, whether by sight of its bluffs or by the talk that rose as we neared the country where the regiment had made its name. The 23rd Wisconsin had served there before I belonged to it. That mattered to me. I was not merely traveling down a river. I was passing through the regiment's past on my way to its present. Those men had stood in the heat and siege lines under Grant. They had earned a knowledge of war I did not yet have. The bluffs and bends of that country were not scenery to them. They were proof. A man can feel humbled by places he has not fought in. I did. I was wearing the same army's clothing, bound to the same company, but there remained a distance between the uniform and the experience. The river carried me over that distance but could not erase it. Only service would do that, and service had not yet fully begun. The lower Mississippi brought heat. It rose first as a softness in the air, then as weight. Clothing that had been comfort in Madison became burden. Wool held the body too closely. The nights could still surprise with chill, but the days told us we had entered another country. The trees changed. The banks changed. The smell of water and vegetation thickened. Men who had joked about the southern climate began to understand that climate itself could be an enemy. Sickness was spoken of often. The regiment's own colonel, Josiah J. Guppy, was ill with the ague in New Orleans. Such news traveled among us because it touched the chain of command and because every man feared the fevers of that country. Bullets announced themselves by sound. Fever enters like a thief. In the Department of the Gulf, disease took men in numbers no battlefield could ignore. New Orleans came at last not as a single sight, but as an accumulation. More boats, more smoke, more wharf, more voices, more goods, more uniforms, more heat, more strangeness to northern eyes. It was the largest port I had ever seen, and the war had made it stranger still. A city under Union occupation is not merely a city. It is a place where commerce, suspicion, discipline, opportunity, resentment, and necessity crowd the same streets. We did not come to New Orleans as travelers. We came as men to be sorted. The camp of distribution outside the city wasn't a destination in any settled sense. It was a holding place, a funnel, a yard where the army gathered men separated from their proper commands and pushed them back toward the front. There were replacements like me, men returning from sickness, men on detached duty, paroled prisoners waiting exchange, and soldiers whose paperwork seemed to govern their bodies more completely than their own will did. The march from landing toward camp gave the body notice that the journey by conveyance was not the end. A man who has sat in rail cars and on boat decks feels his legs complain when they must take up soldiering again. The road dust rose, the sun pressed, the canteen bumped, the haversack strap found the sore place on the shoulder and stayed there. The rifle made itself known with each step. Movement is not one thing in the army. It is many repeated discomforts carried under orders. The camp itself was alive with waiting. Tents, stacked arms, men lying in shade, men drilling, men cooking, men reading, men hunting for news, men asking after regiments, men cursing delays, men too sick to curse. The camp of distribution had no peace in it, only suspension. Each man knew he was there to be sent elsewhere. The question was when and to what. By mid-April, I was there, while the 23rd Wisconsin was already up the Red River. That must be kept clear. I did not see Mansfield on the 8th. I did not see Pleasant Hill on the 9th. Those battles were fought before I joined the regiment in the field. I heard of them afterward in camp, the way men hear of disasters that have already used up their first fury and are now traveling as lists, wounds, missing names, anger, and rumor. The news did not arrive clean. It came in pieces. The army had been checked, then had fought again, then had retreated when some said it should not have retreated. General Banks's name was on men's tongues, not often kindly. The 13th Army Corps had been hard used. Men who had served under Grant felt the difference between commanders, and even those of us newly come could hear the bitterness. A private does not know every design of generals, but he knows when soldiers who have fought begin to speak with contempt. For me, the news had names in it. Robert, Janet's brother, had been up Red River and with the regiment at the time of the fighting. Until word came, he was not an item of military interest. He was a fear in our household. Janet would be waiting to know whether he lived. In the camp, we heard from a wounded man that Robert had been in it and had come out all right. I held that news as something that must get home. Peter LaFlower had not come out all right. He was of our company, from Portage. He had been at Camp Randall when we were there. We knew him well. That is all I had the right to say because I had not seen him fall. But the force of a death is not measured only by what a man witnesses. A name from home, carried south, struck down before I had even reached the regiment, made the war step nearer. Peter's death told me that the company I was going to join had already opened a space that no replacement could fill. There was James Whitney, too, in camp with us, a paroled prisoner waiting to be exchanged. His condition was another form of limbo. Captured, released on parole, not yet returned to full soldiering, not home, not free in the common sense, bound by rules made between armies. I looked at such men and understood that war has many rooms besides the battlefield. A man may be held by sickness, by parole, by paperwork, by orders, by wounds, by memory, by fear. Sunday came in that camp, but it did not keep Sunday as we knew it at home. There was meeting in the morning and evening, and I was thankful for that. Still, a camp Sabbath under orders is not a quiet, peaceful Sabbath in Wisconsin. Men moved, arms were issued, commands interrupted the shape of worship. The Lord's Day stood there, but war stood all around it. I remember that difference because it mattered to me. Faith was not absent from the camp. Peace was. We were marched about a mile and got our guns. The fact is small on paper, but in the body it is not small. The mile had dust and heat in it. The men moved in column. Leather creaked. Canteens struck hips. Someone's blanket roll shifted and had to be hitched higher. An officer's voice came back along the line. A man stumbled and recovered. Another joked, because men will joke at the edge of fear. The guns were placed in our hands, and with them the knowledge that waiting had nearly ended. That night did not feel like the nights on the river. There the boat had carried us, and we could pretend, for an hour at a time, that movement itself was the task. In camp, with the gun issued and orders expected, the body has nothing to do but be ready. Men become restless under such readiness. They check straps already checked. They ask the same questions. They calculate distances without knowing the roads. They speak of letters. They wonder whether mail will follow to the regiment or wander in the rear like an orphan. I had written Janet the week before and had not received letters from her. This was not her fault, nor mine. Mail in war obeyed its own broken roads. Still, knowing the reason did not remove the sorrow. Whatever I was doing, my mind went home. If I tried to read, home entered the page. If I looked across camp, I saw not only tents, but the house I had left. The farther the army carried me, the more the mind walked backward. The heat of the day in New Orleans pressed hard, but the nights could turn cold enough to remind a man that discomfort does not keep one shape. There were greens in market, signs of a growing season far ahead of Wisconsin's. Such things mattered, because soldiers notice what belongs to ordinary life, even when ordinary life has been broken. Food in a market, a church meeting, a letter folded, a man asking after kin. All these were pieces of the world that war had not wholly consumed. Yet, The order was coming. The Red River region lay ahead. The regiment was retreating down from the fighting. Banks's army had been checked. The gunboats and transports, the infantry and artillery, the sick and wounded, the rumors and anger, all of it seemed to be drawing toward Alexandria and the river roads. I did not yet know the country. I did not know the bends of the Red River, the heat above Alexandria, the labor that would be demanded of men to save boats over falling water. I knew only that the time had come for me to share in the struggle instead of traveling toward it. No honest man with a wife and children is eager for death. Willingness is not eagerness. I felt confidence that I should come home, and I put my trust in God. But confidence and trust do not empty the stomach of fear. They give fear a master. I had prayed before. Janet prayed for me as I prayed for her. In camp before marching, such prayer becomes less a custom than a necessity. By the morning of the 25th day of April, the road had narrowed to a point. Wisconsin, Camp Randall, the rail cars, Cairo, the steamboat, the Mississippi, New Orleans, the camp, the Sunday meetings, the mile marched for guns, the news of Robert and Peter and Whitney and Guppy, all of it stood behind me. Ahead was the Red River and the 23rd Wisconsin, no longer a name in a record, but a body of men I would have to join. Before I marched, there was one duty left that no officer needed to order. I had to write Janet. A letter before movement is a strange labor. It must be calm enough not to frighten the one who reads it, and honest enough not to lie. It must say that the writer is well, if he is well. It must carry news before news spoils. It must send love to parents, kin, friends, children. It must speak of God without making piety into ornament. It must leave room for hope, because a wife has to live on something until the next letter comes. The paper was before me. The camp was around me. The order to move stood over the day. Somewhere beyond New Orleans, beyond the river roads and the heat and the rumors, the 23rd Wisconsin waited in the hard country of the Red River. I took up the pen.